As the saying goes, that the man who deserves an introduction doesn't need one. If he needs one, he doesn't deserve it. Something like that, I guess it goes. We have known each other quite a long time, actually. We shared many memorable times together, I think, when we lived on Glenwood Avenue, or Glenwood Street, whatever it was called, in Springfield. Dr. Preuss was quite penurious by nature. I don't know if you know what that means or not. A little tight. Let me just illustrate. We would ride our bicycles together once in a while down a brick street. Springfield had brick streets yet, and that took a measure of courage to do that. And then I remember that that house of his, which was just three or four houses down, was so big, you know, but he had eight children. It needed painting, and you can guess the rest, how the house was painted, I think. They all pitched in, and they got it all done by themselves. It was half the size of the governor's mansion, as I recall, in Springfield. Then we also, I think, shared many a nice ride together over to Champaign-Urbana. I was filling my own vacancy after I had accepted the call to Springfield and going back to Champaign-Urbana twice a week. It was a 180-mile round trip, twice a week, Monday and Thursday night, as I recall, also teaching a full load at the seminary. And finally, I got a little wise, and I asked whether he wouldn't like to teach a course, too. So we put both courses on the same night, Monday night, and we drove over, taking turns. I don't know why it is, but the Presidium of Synod seems to have the world's fastest drivers, as I mentioned this afternoon. Like Jehu, virtually. I learned during those days, my friendship and association with Dr. Preuss, just what it meant when the rubber meets the road. Sometimes. We were 5 miles out of Clinton on Highway 10, which when you drove that highway, you had all of Illinois praying for you. Anyway, when suddenly we heard the most shattering sort of noise, and of course the rubber was flying, I guess. We stopped in a barnyard and a farmer's yard. Looked in, we lost most of the tire, but that really didn't matter because from there on we just didn't need the rubber anymore. We just flew faster, I think, until we got to Clinton and changed to the spare. That was one of the expressions I think I believe he originated, when the rubber meets or hits the road or whatever, and how the cookie crumbles, that one, and canard. There are all kinds of expressions which I picked up in the liberal education which I got from him during that time. And obviously we settled all of Synod's problems too, even before he was president. I believe that one reason why he was made president actually was were his driving habits. I think I began to understand the meaning of ye thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good. I wanted to finish that, to save much faculty alive. We never vied to ride with him down to St. Louis for the joint faculty meetings. Those who came last were the ones who got in his car, I think. That's why Synod has him flying now, I think. As I say, it's not really difficult to introduce someone like him. I'm reminded, though, of the time when Irvin S. Cobb, the famous humorist, was once introduced by some loquacious and maybe not so eloquent a toastmaster like myself. And the toastmaster was brave enough to say, there are some people, you just put a good big dinner into their stomachs and out comes a speech. Well, Irvin S. Cobb got up and he said, you have a wonderful toastmaster. You just put a few words into his mouth and out comes your dinner. I didn't intend to do that to you, really. Especially with those poor, hungry people up there. But it's my pleasure to introduce tonight the president of the Missouri Synod from St. Louis, Dr. Jack J. O. Preuss.
Dr. Klug, I could listen to an introduction like that all evening. And for a while, I was afraid we were going to have to. I have a certain amount of preliminary activity to indulge in. I have been asked to speak to here to this institution, I guess about once a year. It's about all anybody can stand. And have often been accused, in fact, always been accused of being unprepared. Sometimes rightly. So I'm here with presenting to your president a typed manuscript. They say many things about this presentation, but at least it has been prepared. I just got back yesterday from Brazil. The boys from Brazil all send their regards. And I've been mystified ever since I received this invitation. I think this is the first meeting of this kind I've ever had the opportunity to attend, and I was kind of mystified, and I've inquired around. I read this. I had to bring this along because I couldn't remember it. International Center of Lutheran Confessional Studies. You know, that really sounds impressive. So I certainly want to thank the International Center for Lutheran Confessional Studies for this invitation. Then I asked one of your profs here a couple of weeks ago, just what is that? And in typical Fort Wayne style, he said, that's us. But I caution you got to be careful about these things, because one of the boys from Brazil had heard of this. And he said, I'd like to come to the United States to do some studies. And I said, well, don't look at me, Charlie. I haven't got any money. Of course, they never do either. So he said, I think the International Center of Lutheran Confessional Studies would be willing to pay my freight. To turn that over to you, too. That's the first thing that happens when you get a title. Somebody comes around with his hand out. Now, with 10 minutes before chapel, I'll do the best I can and cut out all the frippery. The title that was assigned by the committee was the subject of Chemnitz and the Book of Concord. The most appropriate assignment for this year, and really for any time. So I'm going to whip through this, and then we'll all go to church. Some of us with prayers for, you know, you can pray, Lord, keep me awake, and then you can make up for it when you get over there. The year 1980 is most significant in the life of the Lutheran churches of the world. It is the year in which we celebrate the 450th anniversary of our basic confessional document, the Augsburg Confession, and the 400th anniversary of the publication of the document which really saved Lutheranism as a theological movement and established Lutheranism as an officially recognized and united church. In many ways, the publication of the Book of Concord at the end of the great period of controversy guaranteed the very existence of the Lutheran movement established by the 95 Theses and confirmed by the Augsburg Confession. The Augsburg Confession was followed by 50 years of conflict, both political, theological, and ecclesiastical, to determine whether Lutheranism as a movement and as a church could survive. The adoption of the Book of Concord marks the establishment of Lutheranism, which in turn was able to withstand the terrors of the Thirty Years' War, culminating finally in 1648 in the Peace of Westphalia. This peace, in turn, continued for virtually 300 years until the close of World War II. During these 300 years, almost countless generations of people were brought up under the symbols of Lutheranism, and Lutheranism as a theological entity was established to the point where even the vagaries and the uncertainties of the post-World War II theology, together with the enormous political upheavals of this last generation, have not been able to obliterate it from the face of the earth. It is interesting that in this year, 1980, churches whose Lutheranism has been seriously questioned are celebrating these events and are identifying with the great central truths of the Lutheran understanding of the Christian faith. It is also significant that in this last generation, we have witnessed an erosion of the biblical Christian faith and consequently of confessional Lutheranism that is certainly equal to, if not even greater than, that which was endured during the period of rationalism. Thus, it behooves us once again to study our roots and our theological foundations. Present-day Lutheranism can be extremely grateful to various theologians and churches which have, beginning in 1977 and continuing up to the present, endeavored to state in modern language and in forms which can be studied by clergy and laity alike the basic fundamentals of our faith. I make particular reference to the translation and publication by Concordia Publishing House, one of the board members of which is present here and a graduate of this institution, of the remarkable work translated by Dr. Fred Kramer, former professor here, of the examination of the Council of Trent, written by Martin Chemnitz in the year 1565 to 1573. It was the production of this book which gave him the title, of course, of the Second Martin. Dr. Eugene Klug's outstanding work, From Luther to Chemnitz, is an extremely valuable contribution, as are Robert Preuss's two volumes dealing with post-Reformation Lutheranism. Certainly to be included in this collection of works are A Contemporary Look at the Formula of Concord, edited by Robert Preuss and Wilbert Rosine, sounds like a faculty roster, and with the remarkable historical background of the formula prepared by Robert A. Kolb, the series of materials coming under the general heading of A Formula of Concord, prepared by the Commission on Theology and Church Relations of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Might interest you to know that on the table outside the Brazil Church Convention were many of these books already translated into Portuguese and serving to bring the message of Lutheran confessionalism to South and to Latin America. I also am exceedingly grateful to have been asked by CPH to make my own humble contributions to this effort in the translation of Chemnitz's works on the two natures of Christ and on the Lord's Supper. Other works of significance could also be mentioned. This paper attempts to give in a very cursory fashion a brief summary of the particular and peculiar contribution of Martin Chemnitz to the Formula of Concord. This document should be looked upon, as it was by its authors, as an attempt to state in a succinct and careful language what the correct biblical faith of Lutheranism actually was. It was a preserving document. It makes no pretense of being innovative, but rather is simply an attempt to state Lutheranism's understanding of the biblical faith as it has been enunciated, as it had been enunciated during the preceding 50 years, based on the ancient creeds, patristic evidence, the writings of Luther and Melanchthon, and growing out of controversies which had arisen in the period between the death of Luther and the adoption of the formula over the correct understanding of the gospel. Likewise, the document cannot be understood unless it is very clearly stated that the document looks into the future with the idea that out of the adoption of this document, a united church would arise in lands which had subscribed to the Augsburg Confession and which had every intention under God of retaining that faith. It is really only at the time of the adoption of the Book of Concord that we begin to see emerging a specific body of documents, a corpus doctrinae, for all of Lutheranism. This was an action which pointed not only to the past and to the present state of affairs, but most particularly to the future. Considering the heat of the controversies, the involvement of the great and beloved Melanchthon and his deviation from the common understanding of Lutheranism, the tremendous political pressures which were applied not only by the constant attacks of Rome, but by the conflict with the emerging Reform Party, travel conditions, the use even at this late date of handwritten documents, the absence of typewriters and Xerox machines, the political division within Germany, when you consider all of this, one stands in almost stunned unbelief that a document of this size, with this degree of theological unity, and with such historically binding results, was ever able to emerge. It is certain that in our own age, despite vastly improved communication and transportation methods, printing and all kinds of related technology, we could never possibly come to as high a degree of agreement on as broad a range of subjects within the family of Lutheranism, to say nothing of the ecumenical endeavors which have been undertaken. One could almost say that we have here in this great Book of Concord a miracle. And while a particular person singled out in this paper for emphasis is Martin Chemnitz, who indeed did play a major role, and whose theological stance and personality made the endeavor possible, the fact is that the work is really the work of individuals, of committees, of entire faculties, of leading lay theologians, and of churches, whose entire ministerium ultimately signed the document. One need know very little about the Book of Concord to recognize the names of Andrea, Kitreas, Selnecker, and Chemnitz. But also one has to give special mention to the Elector August of Saxony, to the faculties of Wittenberg, Leipzig, and Tübingen, and also to countless unnamed and long forgotten theologians, pastors, and lay people. The Book of Concord is truly a product of the entire church. In one sense of the word, Chemnitz plays an extremely constant role in the entire development, in that he was chosen from as early as the time when he was librarian at the University of Königsberg, down to the end of his life to serve in capacities of mediation and conciliation among warring factions within Lutheranism. He was selected at a very early date to attempt to bring about conciliation between Flacius and some of his opponents. In this endeavor, he failed in the beginning and succeeded at the end. Very interesting that Chemnitz was born in a very humble family, taken on as kind of a child prodigy by one of his relatives who said, "We've got to get this kid some education." He became a librarian at the University of Königsberg, where he didn't render much service. The duplicating machine was not much good, but he read all the books in the library. He put himself through school as an astrologer and really never had a formal theological education. Did not have a theological degree, and never served as a theological professor. Maybe one reason why I've always felt a certain liking for the guy. Later on, in 1561, he was asked by his mentor, Merlin, to assist him with a certain pastor, Hartenberg, who was charged with crypto-Calvinism. In 1564, he was involved in the development of the Corpus Doctrinae for Brunswick, a document which included the Augsburg Confession, the Apology, the small called articles, and the two catechisms of Luther. This document, quite obviously, was a predecessor to the Book of Concord. In 1568, he met Jacob Andrea for the first time, and both of these men, who had been previously engaged in unification efforts, now began their activities, which resulted ultimately in the development of the Book of Concord. Benti is correct in his statement. Andrea and Chemnitz are the theologians to whom more than any other two men our church owes the formula of Concord, and one can say also the Book of Concord. In these two men, we also have a conjunction between the north and south of Germany, with Chemnitz coming from Brunswick and Andrea from Tübingen. Their first joint effort, at the request of their respective princes, was to conduct a joint church visitation in Brunswick in which they dealt with such articles as justification, good works, free will, adiaphora, and the Lord's Supper. I wonder how many of you in the room who are circuit counselors have ever undertaken that kind of visitation in your circuits. Now, this resulted in a revision of the Corpus Doctrinae of Brunswick, thereafter called the Corpus Doctrinae Julio, in honor of Duke Julius of Brunswick. It is interesting that when they first met, Chemnitz was not entirely certain of the orthodoxy of Andrea. And there may have been some reason for this, because Andrea was charged with having sometimes compromised doctrine in order to bring about unity. During the same period, Chemnitz also made the acquaintance of Selnecker, who had previously been a very ardent supporter of Melanchthon. It appears that Selnecker's conversion to a very orthodox position, which ultimately brought him into a position of authorship for portions of the formula, was brought about by the ministrations and witness of Chemnitz. The effort toward unity really got underway, however, with the publication in 1573 of Andrea's Six Christian Sermons, also published recently by CPH, in which he dealt with the controverted doctrines presently dividing Lutheranism. These sermons might well be called the initial embryo of the Formula of Concord. Picking up speed in the development of material which ultimately found its way into the formula, we note the sermons of Andrea in 1573 recast in thetical form to produce what was known as the Swabian Concord. The Swabian Concord in 1575 was revised by Chemnitz based on comments from theological faculties, conferences, and individual theologians into a document that came to be called the Swabian-Saxon Concord. Osiander and Biddenbach in 1576 drew up the Malbron formula. And at the initiative of Elector August, a conference of theologians was held at Torgau, where the Swabian-Saxon Concord and the Malbron formula were combined into what was known as the Torgau Book. Andrea produced a summary of the Torgau Book, which today we know as the epitome of the Formula of Concord. After various groups had studied and commented on the Torgau Book, it was reworked at Bergen Abbey by Andrea, Chemnitz, and Selnecker into what today is called a solid declaration of the Formula of Concord. For a brief period after 1577, it was called the Bergen or Bergic Book. These documents were an attempt by their various authors and commentators to bring about a settlement of three decades of conflict between the followers of the honored and revered Melanchthon, who had veered off course, and the true or authentic Lutherans, known as the Gnasio Lutherans, who themselves had divided into parties during the years of conflict, the chief divider being Flacius. There was the adiaphoristic controversy, 1548-55, which grew out of the Augsburg and Leipzig interims. There was the majoristic controversy, 1551-62, the synergistic controversy, 1555-60, the Flacian controversy, 1560-75, the Osiandrian controversy, 1549-66, the Antinomian controversy, 1527-56, and the Crypto-Calvinist controversy of 1560-74. I'm sure the boys in the gallery have remembered all those dates. Many of these controversies have their roots in Melanchthon's wavering. Some were prompted by the interims, some by the rise of Calvinism, and all of them had served to divide Lutheranism. The purpose of the Formula of Concord was to reestablish doctrinal unity and doctrinal purity among the followers of the Augsburg Confession, and to bring about peace and harmony among them. It is a great part of the settlement of these controversies. In a great part of the settlement of these controversies, Chemnitz played a significant role. To dwell a little more fully on the theology and personality of Chemnitz himself, it should be pointed out that somewhere during these years of conflict, the decision was made that the documents that were finally drawn up should not contain attacks against people by name, the so-called nominal elenchus. While abundant use is made of the Church Father, is made of the Church Fathers down to Luther, and while Luther is always quoted favorably, I don't think you will ever find him quoted negatively. It is notable that the name of Melanchthon, despite his involvement in so many of the conflicts, is never mentioned in an unfavorable light and very seldom in a favorable light. They ignored him to death.